Prague, now broadcasting in English. You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's show, Czech Books with David Vaughan, featuring another part of Jaroslava Skleničková's moving memoirs, If I Had Been a Boy, I Would Have Been Shot. That will be followed by Science Journal with Christian Falvey, in which he visits the Prague Institute of Plasma Physics, and we'll wind up the show with another part of From the Archives, a history mini-series which Radio Prague is currently rebroadcasting. All that coming up, but we start with Czech Books. This week we hear the fifth part of Jaroslava Skleničková's moving memoirs, If I Had Been a Boy, I Would Have Been Shot, read by the Czech-British actress Veronica Hicks. After the assassination of the Nazi Reichsprotector of Bohemia and Moravia, the butcher of Prague, Reinhard Heydrich, the Czech village of Lidice was chosen for complete destruction on the night from the 9th to the 10th of June 1942. Jaroslava, or Jari, was among 184 women from the village sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp. David Vaughan gives us the story so far.
The women of Lidice are gradually getting used to life in Ravensbrück, making friends with prisoners in other parts of the camp and other work groups. Jari finds herself made to do a variety of jobs, and she comes to learn how important solidarity is among the prisoners. She also begins to understand the arbitrariness and cruelty of the prison guards, and how important it is not to attract their attention. Veronica Hicks reads.
The arrival of more and more transports of women prisoners caused confusion in the listings of the available workforce. Above all, it was essential to select younger women capable of work for the factories producing ammunition, just being built in Germany. The Lagerkommandant, commander of the camp, ordered all women prisoners who were not working anywhere to turn up at the Lagerovka for a roll call. So that not even a mouse could escape, an overseer stood between all the barracks, accompanied by camp police. I was without employment, but I needed to be placed quickly somewhere in a job, so that in some future transport I would not be sent to the ammunition factory, in some subsidiary of the camp, where, apart from hard work, there was the danger of frequent bombings and severed contacts with the main camp. In the end, I was given a job as a kolonka, head of a working column, which kept in good order the paths and grassy areas inside the camp. The work was not hard, but it seemed to me without any purpose. It was October, piercing cold weather. Even though we'd been given winter clothing, that is, striped dresses with long sleeves, and a striped jacket without lining, flannel underwear, knitted stockings, and wooden clogs, that did not warm us much. In my working group, I got 20 Ukrainian women, who were indistinguishable from each other, shaved hair, and each wearing a scarf tied in the same way. I felt sorry for them, and the way they shivered, in inadequate clothing. I got the idea of keeping only 10 of them at work, while the others kept warm indoors. But they had to remember themselves, with whom they'd had to take turns. I stood on the corner and kept a lookout. When the guard approached, then I seemingly urged them and told them what they had to do. As soon as the overseer was out of sight, we chatted, and I learned of their fates. Of course, I did not understand Ukrainian or Russian, but in the camp, the language of communicating among the Slavonic nations was Camp Slavonic, words adopted from each of the languages, and how well we understood each other. When this working column was dissolved, I was set in the group, levelling out the surroundings of the camp. We carried soil along railway lines in metal trucks, similar to those used in mines. It was work that was really laborious, particularly for my legs, which were beginning to fail me. As a child, I had congenital dislocation of the hips. Dragging about heavy cauldrons in the kitchen, standing for ages at the roll call, and now all day long on my feet, all had caused some more damage, and I could barely walk. I was in great pain, and in the end, all I could do was to go to the Revier, the infirmary, in December 1943. The SS doctor got very much interested in my story, and so he had an X-ray made of my hips, on which appeared a quantity of patches the size of a small coin. He asked me where I was working, and I was given another card saying, "Für Außenarbeit umgeeignet und von Lastentragen befreit. Grund, Hüftgelenk Luxation." I was to be excused from outside work and the carrying of heavy burdens for 1 year because of dislocation of the hip joint. I had no idea that it placed me into the files of prisoners earmarked for liquidation. If a certain woman from Brno who worked in the Revier office had not destroyed my card in 1944, I would have most likely perished in the gas chamber. Once again, I was without work. Then one day, a German prisoner came from the camp work office and was looking for skilled dressmakers for the ready-made clothing factory in Fürstenberg, about 5 kilometers from the concentration camp. Danuta put my name down on the list, though I objected that I did not know much about sewing, let alone on machines. She told me, "Remember that in the camp you know how to do anything and everything." I must admit that the night before starting work, I slept very badly, for fear of how it would turn out. But if a person wants to, and must, he will really learn anything. So even I mastered sewing on an electric machine. And in fact, I was the only one to use a 2-needle sewing machine. 100 of us were taken to the Grahl firm in Fürstenberg. Every morning, a lorry with a trailer came for us, driven by 2 French prisoners. Closely packed together, we stood in rain or snow, wind and frost, in the open lorry, without tarpaulin. We were allocated work in the factory, which was inspected by civilian seamstresses. Some of them were very evil, and all of them firmly required the daily quota. At midday, they brought us food from the camp, and for that we had a half-an-hour break. After 12 hours of work, we returned to the camp in the same way. Once during the winter, we were awaited on our return at the entrance to the camp by several guards, who at once started to search us. We were not allowed to bring anything from the working column, but they'd got the idea of finding out if we were wearing only the regulation camp clothing. I felt uneasy, because my aunt had received a parcel from home containing hand-knitted woolen underwear, which she'd given me, because it was too narrow for her. It helped me to protect my sore hips from getting chilled. I could already see that the guard would not only confiscate it, but in addition, she would put my name down for punishment. Just then I noticed that one of them was only checking what we were wearing at the top. Straight away I stepped out to her to be inspected. I'm mentioning this incident to demonstrate that a person in the concentration camp never knew the day or hour when one of the overseers would think up a reason to humiliate and punish. Notorious in this respect was the senior guard, Binz, who had entered service when she was 19. I do not know what she did before, but I could observe especially on her what can happen to a person who unexpectedly gets absolute power over other people. And I was astonished. When I'd been working for Graal several months, they stopped dividing prisoners into barracks according to their nationality. The new division was according to the working columns, and so Mila had to go to the block housing the so-called Dachau Betriebe. With the help of my friend Janina, who had an acquaintance in the work office of the camp, I managed at least to get my mamma to work for Graal. She had been selected several times for the transport, and no one ever knew whether it meant transport to the ammunition factory or to Poland, to the gas chamber. Thanks to the contacts I had with the Polish women, I was always able to save her from those transports. They had not forgotten that I too had more than once, when I was still working in the kitchen, stuck my neck out, and now and again smuggled out some food for them. On other occasions, too, I met with such demonstrations of gratitude and good memory. Once, before my return from Graal, I felt ill. I suffered high fever. I started to stagger, and could scarcely keep on my feet. How I must have looked is clear from the fact that the overseer had a wooden box brought to the lorry for me to sit on, and she kept her eye on me for the whole journey. She probably thought that they would not bring me to the camp alive. When I got to the Revere, the thermometer showed I had 41 degrees centigrade. They diagnosed me with dysentery, and so I was moved into the hospital block. I was placed right at the back, even though I had to run constantly to the lavatory. Here the block leader was a Dutch girl, who was earlier with the French group. She recognized me, came to me, and promised to put me somewhere else in the morning, since mortality was very high in the hospital block. And indeed, in the morning, they placed me in a bed near the door, and what was more, near the window, where my mamma could see me every day.
Tune in again next week for another part of Yaroslava Skleničková's gripping memoirs. Now it's time for Science Journal with Christian Falvey.
Where will the energy of the future come from? If it comes from nuclear fusion, then the compass Tokamak fusion reactor at Prague's Institute of Plasma Physics will have played an important role in making it a reality. It's about as hot as it gets in Prague, and I've been walking around the campus of the Academy of Sciences in Prague's Liben district for half an hour, trying to find which of the inconspicuous prefab buildings houses the Institute of Plasma Physics. I'm sweating like a stoker, and it's only 35 degrees. But here, under the sun, is a great place to start imagining the kind of heat that they're working with inside the walls of the facilities here. The temperatures achieved in the Tokamak fusion reactor reach those inside a star, and I'm going to have a look at it, accompanied by Dr. Pavel Hraska, former director of the institute.
We are now going to see the tokamak. It's a facility where plasma is created in confined by magnetics, a magnetic field. So there are several tokamaks around the world, and our tokamak is called Compass. We got it from the UK, from Callum Science Center in Oxford. And now in the EU, there is a grid of, let's say, smaller tokamaks, some six machines or over or something like that. And they are doing the main basic research for larger tokamaks like JET in the UK and Callum or ASDEX upgrade in Germany.
My goodness. For a science technology buff, this is absolutely beautiful. It's a gorgeous facility.
This is the small tokamak, you know, and I've been showing you the artistic design of new ITER, which will be 10 times larger. And say the tokamak is actually something like a tire in a car. And around there are many coils. There are coils in all directions. And then you fill it with hydrogen, and then you make a discharge, and this hydrogen is ionized, and you will get plasma inside. And this plasma is very hot, and in our case, we will measure many different properties of the plasma doing actually research.
And how hot is the plasma inside?
The plasma in millions degrees C, but actually not too dense. And once you will switch off the coils, magnetic coils, everything is actually gone, because the plasma is formed by magnetic field. And therefore we have these coils, we put all the electricity there, there are magnetic fields, and plasma is kept outside of the wall. Otherwise, because it's a million degrees C, everything would be melted.
So the heat inside this machine is approaching the heat of the sun?
We could probably say that with a certain degree of of correctness.
It's fascinating. It's impossible to imagine what this fairly relatively small machine the size of a few closets can create.
The beauty of fusion reaction is that you can control it very well. You know. Fission reaction, it's difficult to control. Even now, the techniques is much more sophisticated than 20 years ago or 25, Chernobyl and so on. So, but fission is now very safe, but still you have to control the reaction somehow. And here you will switch off the button and the magnetic field disappear and immediately, and there is no fusion. So here you are working with very high electric currents. You cannot use normal cables, so you use this copper basically plates just to conduct the electricity into them.
My goodness, so this, what looks like a glass pillar inside of it, it's actually, this is an entire wire, yeah?
Yeah, instead of wires.
Instead of wires, there are copper plates.
Copper parts.
And how much electricity is coursing through these?
You know, when everything is still under, say, some kind of construction, we are adding new diagnostics, and everything should be finished by the end of this year. But already we have done over 1,000 so-called shots, because they are, again, pulses. Duration, I don't know, 300 milliseconds or something like that. But when everything will be working, we will need something like 50 megawatts. And for that, you know, that would be a good part of Prague, you know, switched off. So we have a special Czech design of power generation. We have a big flying wheels, very heavy. And so by normal electric motors, we are just slowly getting that very heavy things up to 1700 rotation per minute, and we are then making our own electricity for this 1 second or something like that with many megawatts.
So this can make enough energy for half of Prague, but only for 1 second?
Not for half Prague, but a good part of Prague, let's say.
But only for 1 second?
Yes, something like that. And again, we are part of Euratom, you know, so our institute is actually leading the Czech Association of Euratom in fusion. And through our institute, other institutions in the Czech Republic are connected to Euratom, and we are getting Euratom support for this type of research. It's actually an international facility, you know. We have had small tokamak, very small tokamak, and that was, even that small tokamak was used by teams from other countries, and now we have waiting list. Once this compass will be working, there is a waiting list of people who would like to do experiments here, you know, from all over Europe, but even probably from other countries. And even now we have here one Frenchman, one Indian, several people from Slovakia, Ukraine. Now on the long stay here are people from Portugal, from Hungary. They are putting their own, say, diagnostic zero or some instruments. So it's really international undertaking.
They are not going to set the wheels turning and produce any plasma for me today. and from my perspective, the 0.3 of a second procedure would not leave much of a lasting impression anyway. But the data collected will be used for the betterment of the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, being constructed in the south of France, of which the COMPASS is, in a sense, a scale model, the 0.1 of the size. This experimental project should be the beginning of the construction of the world's first fusion power plant, and a revolution in energy production. But the tokamak is only one part of the cutting-edge science being done here in the Institute of Plasma Physics.
This institute is, to some extent, a unique institute. On one side we have this tokamak, then we have this department of pulse plasma, up to all the way to plasma decomposition and plasma spraying. And this institute is really, to some extent, a unique place. I'm not saying the only one, but there are not too many using a different type of plasma, because plasma is not only one. It's thermal plasma, equilibrium plasma, non-thermal plasma, and so on and so. And we are basically involved in all types of plasma here.
What can you tell me about the results of your work here over the last 50 years?
Just a few examples of our results. Department of Pulse Plasma, for instance, developed a special generator of shock waves by plasma discharge. And this generator is used in machines for breaking kidney stones without surgery. And now we are working on applying the similar concepts for cancer tissue, for instance.
So very wide-ranging results.
This is one example. The other example, you have seen this reactor for plasma gasification. And now it's very popular. Everybody is looking for alternative ways of energy or whatever. And this is not actually, say, incineration, but it's gasification. We are not using oxygen. When you have incineration, you use oxygen. Actually, you are burning something. We are not burning that material. We are decomposing it using the plasma chemical layer.
So there's no waste left over from it?
Very little. So this is another things we are working on, and we have patented that design and fusion. So we are part of the fusion community in Europe, and we are highly regarded as one of really based laboratory in fusion, and therefore we were offered this tokamak, otherwise we wouldn't get it, you know. Or we have now patented technique for making bulk nanomaterials, bulk nanocoatings by plasma spraying, which is just original. Everywhere we go to conferences, everybody is surprised, you know. And so I think that the institute is very well fixed in the world community.
That was Dr. Pavel Hraska of the Institute of Plasma Physics. And that's all the science we have time for today. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune in to Science Journal this time next month.
My thanks to Christian Falvey for this week's science, and in the last part of our show today, another part of David Vaughan's history series from the archives.
We are in Prague. It is just before midday on St. Valentine's Day, February the 14th, 1945, and we hear the familiar sound of an air raid siren, captured here in a Czech broadcast from the time. In previous weeks, Czechs had got used to the sirens, as Allied bombers had launched raid after raid on German cities. But so far, the German-occupied Czech capital had been spared. This time it was different. Around lunchtime, a fleet of American flying fortresses dropped 152 tons of bombs over the densely populated centre of the city. The result was 701 people killed and over 1,000 injured. The bombing was probably a mistake, as a huge raid on nearby Dresden was underway at the same time. But it gave the German occupiers a perfect opportunity to turn the raid into a propaganda coup. Here was Prague Radio the next day.
Včera jsme plně pochopili význam slova teror, které znamená český hrůzy.
Yesterday we fully understood the meaning of the word terror, the reporter declares. With the building still on fire, he goes on to describe the scene in a city cafe where dozens of unidentified bodies are lying, burnt or dug out from the ruins. A few days later, the dead were buried and the mass funeral was a big propaganda opportunity. The reporter describes how the city's Nazi officials, with their right arms raised in a Hitler salute, say their final farewell as the dead are buried in their simple wooden coffins. While the bombing of Prague was a mistake, air raids on some of the heavily industrial towns and cities of the Protectorate most definitely were not. Here, the Protectorate radio in the city of Brno announces, first in German and then in Czech, that it is suspending broadcasts as enemy aircraft are approaching. In a series of air raids by the Americans and Soviets in 1944 and 1945, Brno suffered considerable damage, in residential as well as industrial areas. 1,200 people lost their lives, and over 12,000 buildings were damaged.
That was from the archives, and I'm afraid that's all we have for you today. You'll find us online at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then our email address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you as always. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for listening and do join us again sometime soon.
vous écoutez Radio.